recording now on our third set of tapes.
So you had this house on a side hill in a valley there, a very nice place, and there's some woods in there too. So frequently, several of us would go out there on a Saturday and cut wood, cut down, thin out trees, dead wood, and so forth. And on occasion, Greeny and his wife Margareta and Julian Hill, there was another man, don't recall now, would come out, and they'd have maybe a quartet of instrumental music that'd play out in the open very nicely.
Greenwald's wife played?
Yes.
And
I don't remember that. Well, Julian Hill, I think, had a violin. I don't remember the actual composition now.
Let's see. Julian Hill's still living, isn't he?
As far as I know. He's sort of crippled, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had infantile paralysis, which left him in sort of a bad way. One shriveled leg.
Yes, I remember his...
But he did skate for a number of years.
Yeah, I used to skate with him over at the Wilmington Skating Club. Yeah. I run into him over there. You did too. You were skating.
And
are you still
skated
skating?
At the skating club up until, well, I think he stopped at least 5 years ago. Because he had a bad fall in his backyard, I think it was.
No, I see.
That hurt him some more.
Well, to do some really big name dropping, did you ever have any contact with Pierre DuPont? Pierre S. DuPont?
Yes, in several ways. In fact, all three of the brothers, Irene and Lamont and Pierre DuPont. Lamont and all three through entertaining Swedberg.
Oh yes,
that was the first contact. And Irene took us on a boat trip in his yacht down the Chesapeake, and somewhere near the Sassafras outlet, we pulled aboard a youngster who had got out too far and needed help, so we pulled him in.
The DuPont brothers, or Irene or Pierre, were sufficiently impressed with Swedberg that they wanted to entertain him, or they invited him?
Yes.
How many visits back did he make?
Oh, he made perhaps half a dozen.
I see.
And I think that was the only contact I had with Lamont. It could have been that in the very early days when we had to report to probably the top management. We made one or two reports to that on our work under this fundamental research project.
Paul Arthur told me one time that Irene DuPont kept close tabs on the chemical department, the research, even after he retired as president.
Yeah.
And
well,
he read all the reports, and apparently, particularly the reports pertaining to inorganic pigments and minerals, very closely.
Oh, I see.
I don't know whether you, maybe he didn't follow your work that.
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, we also, when Swedberg was here, were invited to Grenoble for the fireworks at 4th of July. Mm-hmm. And so for a number of years afterwards, we got invitations until they decided they'd had enough of us.
How about Walter Carpenter, Jr.?
I have to get around to Pierre.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Of course, Longwood was especially a place that Svedberg would like from his botanical standpoints. But Mr. DuPont, at the time that the Brandywiners were young, and when his wife was still alive, took great interest in the Brandywiners. And if the season was right, he'd bring baskets of peaches and set them out for us to munch on. And at the end of a show, at the end of the final show, he would have the whole group, which sometimes ran up to the order of 100, for a party in the open space in front of his house. Set up a barn. I don't know how some of the youngsters got home, but maybe they were cautious about indulging, but I doubt it. And a very handsome buffet. So he was very kind to us. But then, now you want Walter Carpenter.
Yes.
I had several contacts with him. See, he was a Cornelian and gave X millions to the university, especially for the engineering department. And he also, for some years, would invite the Cornell Club of Delaware out to his farm for a picnic. So he would come to an annual meeting on occasion. He had considerable interest in the local club. Mm-hmm. So I knew him through the Cornell Club. But he was a very good man.
Yes, he was a... He really was put in charge of there. They created the development department under his wing in around 1918. And Tom Axton, who was in the development department back in the 60s, wrote a history of the DuPont Company, which was based on basically on what Waller and Carpenter's ideas had been and what they'd set up. And, but the interesting thing about that history was he didn't mention Carruthers or nylon. Or neoprene.
those are too mundane.
I could never convince Tom that he was he'd missed something.
Who was it?
The fellow named Tom Aston, who was head of the development department downtown in the 1960s, maybe late 60s, and I think he was trying to justify the development department and some of the modern changes. This might be a good point to digress into that, DuPont research philosophy and research management. Can you briefly say how that developed and changed over the years from the time you came?
There were several changes. When I first came, there was no general indication as to what one had to work on. You picked your problem. And somehow I got into pigments. My first years were devoted mainly to white pigments and colored pigments and dye, colloidal dyes. Not the substantive ones. And so then the first restriction came in during the Depression when Dr. Bolton took over, because he was known for wanting to be able to punch a cash register from the work that was in progress. But under the circumstances, it was not as restrictive as it might, as you might have thought it would be, since they kept their whole staff. Then, of course, during the war, everybody was busy enough so they didn't have time to think. They just did what they could. Hmm. But then after the war, under Greenwald, blue sky research was in order. But then, I guess there was sort of handwriting on the wall or something. Things were not going as well towards the cash register as they might. I'm not very clear about that, but anyway, then the outer, the extended experimental station developed so as to bring the departments closer together.
But that was the big expansion of the experimental station, though, in 1948, I think. There was a big expansion.
Yes,
to do that.
Yes.
Wasn't that an increase in research staff, or was that just collecting
well,
down to Wellington?
Bringing in from the other departments their more basic research, so there could be more interchange.
But it was my recollection that the operating department still kept their independent labs by and large until almost the 70s or 80s now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But there was a belt tightening after the Greenwald era or during the Greenwald era, as far as you see. Greenwald was president until 1962.
And this first expansion of the station was it 51?
48, 1948, I think.
48, the first one.
48, and that was completed maybe. Buildings were added, like elastomers was added in 1953.
Yeah.
That was a new department then, of course.
Yeah. Well, I think that some of the young chemists were sort of branching out to such an extent that there didn't seem to be any real future in what they were doing.
I worked in an operating department in those days, and I can assure you that was the opinion of some central research in those days.
Yes, I think that probably developed to such an extent that they did have some restriction put on.
Let's go back to your professional activities, professional society activities. You were involved early on in the Division of High Polymer Physics of the American Physical Society.
Yes, I was there through its inception, and I served as its chairman for, I guess, whatever it was, a year. At the same time, I was on the steering committee or board, whatever it was, of the polymer chemistry division.
You were a member of the American Physical Society from your Cornell days or early DuPont days?
No, I joined during the war.
I see.
Because so many of my contacts were physicists.
And when did you say you were in the organizing group, or at least in the original Division of High Polymer Physics group?
Yeah.
Who was mainly responsible?
Mark was, I think, the...
Herman Mark?
Yes, he was probably the main organizer.
And did you continue active with them after your chairmanship? Or
for some years. But much earlier, I was at the organizing meeting at Evanston of the Electron Microscope Society. That was, I don't know, can't put it, maybe 1940,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in that range. So I knew all the work, all the good scientists in that group, and I suppose I, you know, colloid I'm not sure if I was ever a member of the colloid group or not.
There was a cellulose, and was the cellulose and colloid together at one time, or and there is a.
They've
changed over the years, so it would be hard to trace for me.
But then I was involved in the Gibson Island conferences and the Gibson Island in New Hampshire, which they entitled it for some years until it developed much bigger than the original Gibson Island conferences.
Were these perhaps forerunners of the Gordon Research conferences or something?
Yeah, these are Gordon Research.
Gordon Research.
Yes. See, they took over this.
But they started off as Gibson Island? Is
that, yes.
That was where?
That's in the Severn River or Chesapeake, just outside of Annapolis. Hmm. And so the group. Now, I don't remember who the main organizer was, wanted a good isolated spot, not too isolated, for a series of meetings, seminars during the summer. And so it turned out that this Gibson Island, which was owned by a group of Baltimore and Annapolis people as a country club, was in bad straits because of the war. They couldn't get to it, that sort of thing. So they agreed to build a conference room, a conference building, away from the main building, where they would still be functioning somewhat. And so then we had the week-long conferences there. And at one time, well, we had the use of the bar in the main building, that was all. And they had two drinks. They had Planter's Punch and mint juleps. So at one time that I was down there, along about, let's say, 10 o'clock or 11, we decided to be, this was about the 4th of July, decided to be a good time to sing a couple of Christmas carols. So Gordon comes down in his bathrobe with his eyes flashing and says, "Get the hens, get home."
Who was Gordon? This was the...
He was the organizer. He was the head,
of the
conference.
Yeah, yeah.
Neil Gordon. And then when we got to the meeting place at 9 o'clock the next morning, he gave us about a half-hour lecture on etiquette, behavior, and so forth.
The Gordon conferences got to be, that was a big part, the sociability was a large part of the Gordon conference.
Oh, yes.
When I was
much of the exchange of ideas happened during those social hours. It work was discussed there, which would appear as published articles maybe a year hence.
Yes. You were also involved in the Society for Applied Spectroscopy.
I was at that particular conference. I was down at that time was the ASXRED. American Society for X-ray and Electron Diffraction. Because we had a little electron diffraction going with our electron microscope.
Who did the electron microscope work in your days?
Henry did. This was Henry. He started got in working order, but then Willoughby took it over.
Yes.
And Henry always had to get Willoughby out of trouble. He was not really mechanically inclined or instrumentally inclined.
My wife was an electron microscopist in textile fibers, and this was Angela Wierzbowski, and I came to the conclusion that electron microscopists are a very temperamental bunch. Is that your feeling?
It could be, yes.
They never trusted each other, among other things. They always had...
Well, there are so many things that could go wrong.
It's a very
so many artifacts.
It's an esoteric business, I'd say. Well, it's important.
Because even the size of particles could have changed if they got too much too concentrated a beam on them.
Were you involved in the organization of the Society for Applied Spectroscopy, or just a member? I know you were very supportive.
I was just a member. Mm-hmm. I didn't.
I can recall you used to bring your harem with you, Alan Wallace and Pete Slichter and sometimes Kay Looney, I guess, to SAS meetings,
yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Was this your way of encouraging them to engage in more aware, or I guess I ought to back up and ask the question, what's your feeling about professionalism, particularly with respect to participation in professional societies and attending meetings and that sort of thing, as it was back when you started and has changed over the years?
You never know what contacts you'll make. A casual word dropped that we ran into this problem and it worked out this way might just solve a problem for the one that attended the meeting. In an instrumental society, there's so many possibilities. Of course, if you're deeply involved in organic chemistry, the same thing applies.
Yes.
But an outsider going to an organic meeting wouldn't necessarily pick up very much.
Yeah, with respect to the Delaware section of the American Chemical Society, which has been one of the most successful, I've heard reports that you had very good attendance and very well attended meetings back in the 30s, during that period, and maybe during and after World War II. Was that?
That was about the time when things got a little started to go down, I think, after the war. But in the 30s, it was really flourishing.
The local section ACS has had its problems in recent years, and except for maybe a few really outstanding things like the Carruthers lectures, Carruthers Award lectures, and
I know.
But do you have a feeling for why that is?
Oh, I think that it's probably a matter of so many different ways of spending your time. That came up. That is, right after the war, they were accustomed to a fairly austere sort of living, not being able to go off weekends very much, and TV was just coming up. In fact, I forget when the first real sets came. The first TV that I saw was at the World's Fair of 1940. Mm-hmm. I don't think they became general until around 60? 55?
Probably.
And that makes quite a bit of difference when you have to fight a good program against a possible dull lecture.
Do you decry, or what's your feeling about the proliferation of specialized societies?
Well, I think it's probably a step in the right direction, because I think in any given year there's a limited number of people that could come to a general, could be invited to a general meeting, who would be able to draw the whole spectrum of the chemists.
We pause just a minute and let me and let both of us collect our thoughts a bit and see if there's anything else we want to cover.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay, I think let's turn to a quick rundown of some of the people, your associates at DuPont that you'd like to mention.
Well, Sam Leonard would be a good one to start, but he was the son of prestigious professor at Wisconsin, and I had him I was the lab assistant. He was going through, I think it was physical chemistry. That was my first contact with him. And then he graduated, and we both went over to Europe. He spent some time in London, I think, working on a doctorate, and then went to Germany and worked with Bodenstein. Mm-hmm. And so I met him in Berlin one time. We had dinner together. And then we both came to DuPont. And he very soon figured that he'd better get into more practical things, the practical end rather than pure research.
I mean, he was ambitious and yes, in the business sense.
He could see that his progress would be much greater that way. On one occasion, we would take walks together around. It was possible to walk around Alapocas Woods. It was just a dirt road at that time, and there was one problem that I thought might come up, and that would be centrifuging something that at high temperature, fairly high, well, that is, say, 100 degrees. Mm-hmm. And he said, why don't you just go ahead and develop such a thing? But as I didn't have any immediate use for it, I didn't. Didn't follow through on his advice. But he and, I see, Kistiakowsky was there too.
Oh, yes, George Kistiakowsky. Yeah.
Just for, I think, a summer or something like that.
Now, this was before he went to Harvard? Or
before he went to Harvard.
And, so he'd have been coming into this country from Berlin, or is he somewhere? Didn't he finish at the University of Berlin? Kistiakowsky.
I don't know what his background was.
Do you remember where he came from arriving at DuPont? Then?
No.
Did you know him or work with him? No, in any sense?
I just knew him, that was all. Didn't have any real contact with him. Kaufman was a very odd man. I don't know that I mentioned
him. You mentioned I forget where you said he was from, but he had some
strange ideas. He was Romanian and had some time at, I think it was the University College in London with Donovan. I didn't dredge up before. This was Kaufman.
There were two Kaufmans. The one was the COF, and there was a Daniel Kaufman, yeah, wasn't it? And that's the other.
But
that's another.
Don. It was Don.
Don Kaufman.
He was Midwest. Mm-hmm. Quite.
He made some important contribution in Rhode Island development, didn't he?
Yeah, I don't remember what it was at the moment.
It seemed to be he had a patent on drawing or processing or something of fiber.
Of course, Julian Hill was the first one to draw
yes
the polymer.
Yes.
And I had already mentioned Hood Worthington as being just the man for instrumentation on this new process of hot melt spinning.
Let's see, was he the one that was involved in the melt rheometer, or this was...
No, that was Guy
Taylor. Guy Taylor, how about Howard Starkweather? This was the senior, of course. He went on...
He was in the rubber division.
He went on to organic chemicals, rubber division then. And,
I knew him more socially than actually scientifically. So I can't make any particular comment.
He ended up at a fairly high level in Orchem, I think.
Yes,
finally.
You'd mentioned
Tanberg. I guess I was just going to check with you to see whether a story I'd heard is true. The tale I've heard was that Tanberg and Henry DuPont were drinking buddies, and that. This was this was the way Tanberg got informal or behind the scenes approval for a lot of his ideas in the days when he was the director. Did you know that?
No, that was.
Or do you believe that?
It could be. He was sort of a staid gentleman, though.
Tanberg was.
Yes.
Or maybe it was somebody else. The tale I heard was that. Henry DuPont, of course, was which one I don't remember was, but he was on the DuPont board, exec committee, and that they would meet every afternoon at the tavern down on along the Brandywine.
Haggie's.
Yeah, probably, and that they'd have a couple beers together and talk over. I don't know.
The Brandywiners rehearsed Breck's Mill, and the tavern was only a quarter of a mile away, so we'd congregate that afterwards. And I remember we were giving the show Merry England, and in that they have a mask in which I was an Egyptian dancer. So several of us that were in that got up on the tables and went through a few motions. We hadn't had more than one beer, I'm sure.
Somehow I wouldn't have pictured that. You always seem so very staid and sort of formal to me when I first met you at DuPont and at Society of Affairs. Well, maybe it wasn't Tanberg then. I might have my story mixed up.
It could be, but
I think Harvey Hain told me that. And
he
Harvey is
sort of struck fear in the eyes and the heads of applicants when he went out to interview them.
That would be consistent with what I've heard also.
Yeah.
He was, is it true that he was fairly, he was the boss and he did the hiring and firing and he ran a pretty tight ship, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
How about Stein? Stein was apparently the
he was the chemical director at that time.
Chemical director, and he was the one who, was it? Do you think it was his idea or
it was his idea.
Somebody else to do the fundamental research?
As far as I know, it was Stein's.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of another name. And I knew him in various ways. You have mentioned Cole Coolidge. Cole Coolidge especially I liked. He was... some people didn't like him too well, but he seemed to take a special liking to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably his say that gave me the 3-month trip to England after the war to go through all the ICI laboratories and university labs and institutions in England, because whoever was the first choice couldn't make it. So then I took over, and he was the only real friend I had, I think, in the steering committee at that point.
I see.
But I was shocked, of course, as everybody else was, when he died. It was roughly in that same year, I think, wasn't it, 53?
I don't have any knowledge on that or anything.
It was close to that.
Let me ask about Berchet. Wasn't he? Did he have some important inventions or one?
Well, he did. He did a lot of the early work on the polymers with Carruthers. He's mentioned very favorably in when that early work has gone over.
Does he do early work on Delrin or the Delrin forerunner?
I sort of doubt it, because he went into patents. I forget whether it was before the war or roughly is somewhere in that range.
I'm curious about that. You had Berchet and Arnold Collins, who had at least had some distinguished accomplishments in synthesis, and they ended up in the patent division. I think that was their desire, or did they kind of get burned out?
Well, it's hard to say. You can always look at it both ways. Or perhaps a third way, that their writing was good enough to show that they had real promise in developing a proper patent procedure. Because a properly written patent means a lot.
Yeah, I hadn't looked at it that way. I think we always sort of looked down on the patent division and information division, or information systems people, perhaps unfairly. Well, the jobs were not as glamorous, certainly.
No, sure they weren't. It was hard work, because so much of it amounted to literature research, and patent literature especially.
Yeah.
Which would be about as dull reading as you could imagine.
Yeah, I can. Okay, we're back to 1928 then, as far as these particular people are concerned. I don't know if there are any others that...
Well, Dr. Bolton, of course, I had quite close contact with. Also Dr. Benger, who came down, I guess, at the same time that the main expansion took place and the textile fibers came down.
Now, there was a Benger lab down at Waynesboro.
The same
Benger. Is that the man?
Yes, he started up at Buffalo in Rayon. I knew him up there. And so he was responsible for whether he actually was down at Waynesboro or not, I don't know. But anyway, he was a good man.
Yeah, he had some outstanding polymer research, or polymer,
well, he,
I guess
he,
since he was the Rayon division, he was a polymer man of sorts.
Present during the development of the, I think of Dacron, Orlon, and that group, that early group. He had his hand in that. But, well, I was going to comment on Bolton. I think it was, this could have been during, yeah, it was during the time that I was acting head of the little physics group. we wanted some equipment, and I forget whether it could have been the mass spec. My timing is not very good. But anyway, we wanted something that was costing about $25,000, which was a fair amount of money in those days. And Bolton remarked that, well, I'm sure glad that you're not asking for something around $100,000.
he could stomach $25,000, but yeah. Well, of course, he had to go up to another level of management to get approval for, I suppose yeah. The break was somewhere around $50,000 or $100,000.
Might well be.
Yeah, have to go to a vice president.
Yeah.
Where did he, did he go on elsewhere then after Central Research? Or
no, he retired from as chemical director.
Mm-hmm. Then Salzberg came in, or was he Salzberg the director after Bolton, or was there somebody else earlier?
I'm trying to think.
Earlier?
I think it was Salzberg and then McQueen.
Right, it was, that was the direct, that was the succession of Salzberg.
Yeah. Yeah. And after that I've lost track.
Well, Paul Salzberg was an organic chemist from Illinois, I believe.
Yeah.
Synthetic, did he work in polymers at all, or was he mostly just original organic?
Don't recall what his field was.
And McQueen, of course, is a physical chemist.
Yeah. Good Canadian.
Oh,
I don't know
right
if he
too.
Ever was naturalized.
Oh. He's still in Delaware, raising horses, I think.
Oh, no, he died several years back.
Oh, McQueen died. I see. Yeah. I think I didn't... I'm sorry, I'd forgotten.
He
that.
Was yeah. raising horses,
yeah.
though.
Okay. And here's some lists from 1927, which was the year you arrived.
Yeah.
Some of these people you've already mentioned, I think.
George Schwartz was, I forget what his field was, but he became safety, in charge of safety, and instituted some of the things which helped us have good safety records.
Brubaker is a name that rings
oh,
a bell
yes.
with me, and I don't, I can't.
I wonder. Yeah, Brubaker was head of the station chemical department. I think Salzberg was assistant. But I think that probably Brew refused the step up, and Salisbury took it. I guess that's what it was.
Okay, I remembered him as having some connection with the management.
I may be wrong. In
Gordon Patterson, of course, you worked
with. I worked with him
for many years.
Yes, because he had the pigment work at the station, along with Cliff Sloan, who did a lot of the developmental work on the TiO2 process. And so I was quite close to him.
Patterson, was he had an organic background or inorganic, or was he?
He wasn't organic, I'm pretty sure. He graduated from Mead up in northwestern Pennsylvania. I don't know, then he went to Ohio State, I think, for his graduate work. But I know he didn't have, I'm pretty sure he didn't have an organic background. It may have been physical chemistry.
I inferred this perhaps from the title, whereas from the Nature Research Group he had one time earlier. It was before this. But, well, this was an interesting. This is what this is, a summary report of the only one I found. This was a short summary report by Tanberg in August of 1927, in which he described briefly what the various groups were doing and what the various assignments were in terms of the projects they were working on. And I copied the ones that seemed to be polymer-related.
Oh, yes.
Kaufman, nitrocellulose solutions and films. Aleph group was working on paints. Keats group was working on Duco undercoats. Parrott group on auto top coats, colored auto top coats. And here was the Patterson group, Bostwick lures on Duco undercoats and quick drying enamels. Murray paints containing nitrocellulose, and Shive and Wernz on paints.
Yeah.
Do you remember those projects or that any of that work?
I remember all those people. Bostwick was a playboy. He didn't stay with the company very long. Bill Lures, I guess, was competent. I don't remember much about him. Murray, I don't recognize. Shive, I think, was at Philadelphia eventually. And Jim Wernz, of course, was at the station for a good many years. He died some years back. Well, I've forgotten what his first name.
Thomas?
Yeah.
It's interesting that these charts. I have to switch the tape. Thank you.